Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, roughly from Gramsci, I welcome to the Time of Monsters podcast. I'm GT here of the nation. This podcast is widely available on all podcasting platforms. This week, it's actually very appropriate that we begin with a quote from Gramsci, because this week we're going to talk about someone who was a historian of Italy, 20th century Italy, and the fascist era that Gramsci lived through and died under. But who's also, I think, very fits into the Gramscian model of being part of this time of monsters. I'm of course talking about Michael Ledeen. He's a historian, as I mentioned, but he's also a man of action. He was an intellectual who put into practice his ideas, and he was a very prominent member of the sort of neoconservative movement. Most famously or infamously, he was one of the originators of the Iran-Contra deal, which became a major constitutional crisis in the 1980s. But I actually think, I mean, like, if you actually look at his biography, he pops up all over the place over the last 40 years, usually with very nefarious people. And we'll talk about this, but like in the late 70s, we can see him bringing in disinformation from Italian intelligence into the United States. And then, as I mentioned, Iran-Contra. And then later in the George W. Bush administration, he was one of the main promoters of the idea of weapons of mass destruction and of yellow cake. And later, with his wife, he was very close to Steve Bannon and Michael Flynn and others in the more coup-oriented members of the Trump administration. So this guy, I mean, I would actually describe him as the Forrest Gump of American fascism. He's always somehow on the scene. And to sort of talk about him, I'm very happy to have on returning guest, Jacob Heilbronn, who is of at the National Interest. Am I right?
Yes.
Editor at the National Interest. But for our purposes, also someone with connections with the neoconservative movement and has written a very lively and important book on the history of the neoconservative movement. They knew they were right. Ledeen figures as a minor character, but he's in that book along with many other great favorites. Norman Potteritz and William Crystal. So I think Jacob is a perfect guest to talk about him, but I think we should, pull back and just get the basic biographical material. So Jacob, what can we say about who Michael Ledeen was?
Well, in essence, he was a failed academic. Mm-hmm. He earned a PhD under the great German historian George Masi, mm-hmm. who was an exile from Nazi Germany. Masi actually went to England before World War II and studied there. And then he came to the University of Wisconsin at Madison, which is where Ledeen met him and earned his PhD on Italian fascism. Ledeen himself grew up in California, and it was interesting because he himself said that in the 1950s, as a child growing up, he became interested in history because of the history of the Holocaust. His parents were Jewish, and he was trying to decipher, like many of us have, why it all happened, which is, of course, an endless question. But Ledeen plunged into the academic studies, and he was denied tenure at the University of Washington, and then came to Washington, D.C., where he quickly made a name for himself as a neoconservative. He himself thought of himself, he did vote for George McGovern in 1972 against Richard Nixon. He is a classic neoconservative, not belonging to the Podoritz generation, which came of age in the 40s and 50s, but a later younger generation that sort of coalesced around figures like Scoop Jackson.
Yeah. I mean, this is a little bit in the weed, but I sort of always associate him with people like Joshua Mrchavchik or Arch Puddington, that sort of people who were like had a new left background, often Social Democrats USA, Carl Gershwin, and really took the sort of internationalist, democratizing human rights element of the left and brought it into neoconservatism.
But with Ledeen, there is a much sharper edge to it. I mean,
yes.
You know, I wouldn't think of Arch Puddington or Carl Gershman as scholars, and I don't think they conceive of themselves as that. Mm-hmm. Ledeen really did have the chops initially. Mm-hmm. Masi produced an incredible number of top-flight historians. And interestingly, he didn't really discriminate among his students. Another one, I can't resist throwing this in as a footnote, Jeet. Even you may not know this piece of conservative trivia, but another of his students was Burton Yale Pines, who was the vice president at the Heritage Foundation. And then subsequently, years after he left Heritage, Pines recanted it all, the conservative dogma. But Ledeen never did. Ledeen operationalized fascism in a weird way. Masi was, I think, as you pointed out in one of your articles, was fascinated by the symbols of fascism. Mm-hmm. And, he emphasized, looked heavily.
I mean, like, to sort of place Masi himself in the historiography, I mean, obviously the early historians of Marxism were very interested in the sort of the politics, the sort of machinations. Masi came, the sort of revisionist that said, like, no, this is not just a political movement. It has a powerful cultural dimension, and was very interested in all the sort of cultural manifestations, often in like mass media and low culture. Like the Nazis really came out of the gutter of European culture. And Masi was like a hugely, I want to underscore this. This is like a very serious man and a hugely important scholar of fascism. And Ledeen was his student, and I actually collaborated with him on a book. So he got a lot from Masi.
Yeah, and the interesting thing, I think, as you noted, was that Ledeen, in a way, tried to operationalize these concepts for the right.
Yes.
That he took the criticisms and the observations that Masi had made, and essentially he had some kind of a strange attraction to Italian fascism, and has been accused of whitewashing it, in fact. And as you know, And as we're, I guess we're going to discuss, Ledeen himself became involved with some dubious figures in Italy itself.
I want to mention, like, among coming out of the scholarly background, like, you know, one of Ledeen's early books, which I've read and actually quite enjoyed as a book, is The First Duce. It's about Gabriella D'Annunzio, who was this kind of prefigured a figure, Mussolini before Mussolini. He had been involved in a sort of coup and was a cultural figure, a writer and aviator. And the book is, it's a good book, makes a very powerful case that, you know, this is a sort of prefiguration of fascism. But also, I think that any honest reader would have to say there's a huge amount of admiration for the First Duce. There's a sense that this is an adventurer. This is someone who realizes the weaknesses of liberal democracy and realizes we need action and dynamic movements. This is someone who's a great artistic figure and can manipulate the media. And so there is this, you know, the joke I would use is the classic Twilight Zone episode, which is, you know, the aliens come with this book called To Serve Man, and it's a cookbook. So George Mossi wrote the cookbook, you know, How Fascism Operates, and Ledeen seems to have taken it as a how-to guide.
Well, the interesting thing about him is that there is this double-edged sword with Ledeen, even more than with many of the neocons, is that he purports to espouse democratization, but at the same time, he has this admiration for, dare I say, a Trump-like figure.
In many ways,
when you look at Ledeen's writings, I think he's not that dissimilar, actually, from another figure who died recently, Angelo Codevilla, at the Hoover Institution. These guys have an infatuation with the military and the strong man, and they claim that this is the only way to protect American democracy, in essence, destroying the village to save it.
Yeah, no, that's right. Yeah. So we have a kind of like theoretical background, and I think it's important to see how it operates in practice. Because, so as you mentioned, he was a failed academic. And I actually believe that there've been longstanding rumors that there's a sort of plagiarism scandal, which is why he didn't get tenure. He was able to move away from academia into politics. And in the late 1970s, he made connections with the Italian intelligence agency, SISMI. And he says he was a consultant for them. This is where things get interesting, because in 1980, he co-authors articles in the New Republic about Billy Carter, correctly pointing out that Billy Carter was receiving money from the Libyan government, but then also saying that this influenced Carter administration policy. The Wall Street Journal did an investigation based on Italian court records. And it turned out that the source for this information was an Italian intelligence agent, a senior SISMI figure named Francesco Pazienza. I might be getting the name not perfectly, but do you want to talk about this sort of SISMI connection and what SISMI was actually all about in the late 1970s when Ledeen was first made his ties with them?
Well, you know, fascism never really went away in Italy after World War II. And there was this organization called the P2 Lodge. Mm-hmm. And that is what Ledeen was allegedly in contact with. Mm-hmm. Now, he stoutly denied it. But Ledeen was involved in this smear campaign against Jimmy Carter to claim that his brother Billy was somehow engaged in nefarious activities in Libya, and that this intelligence had been provided from Italy. And it turned out to be completely bogus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Now, this P2, I mean, okay, so Ledeen did deny connections with the P2 Lodge, but the Italian intelligence officer that I mentioned had been convicted in Italy. And part of the conviction included involvement with Ladin and with this Billy Carter affair. It depended not just on the testimony of Pazienza, but also on other evidence from other Italian intelligence agents. And Ladin's denials were, he did deny they took money from SISMI that went into like a bank account in Bermuda. And he just denied, I guess, the sums that were involved. And he denies like that he was involved with the lodge. What I want to underscore is, the Italian intelligence officials that he had contact with, these are like, you know, within the context of Italy, had been involved with some very like horrific things. The P2 Lodge was involved with sort of terrorist bombings, which were designed to discredit the left. Ladin's alleged handler helped cover that up. And this actually brought down a government in Italy. So, I mean, we're talking about people who were like, you know, I think it's fair to say, were, you know, fascists who are trying to destroy Italian democracy.
Right. But Ladin, you know, he always, look, he was clearly prepared to take a walk on the wild side. I don't know if you remember Leon Wieseltier's comment about him, which was that, I don't despise Michael Ladin because he's a neocon, but because he's a con.
Yeah. And we'll return to the Italian connection, as we go walk through the biography, because it appears at several other points. Willingness to work with people who are, like on the fringes of the law and sometimes on the wrong side of the law, I think reappears in the sort of Iran-Contra thing, which he was like, you know, like not a major figure, but I think he was an instigator. He was like involved with at the beginning. Do you want to like lay that out a little bit?
Yeah, I think we should say that Ladin's salad days came during the Reagan administration.
Yeah.
When he was serving in the administration. And this, for the neocons, really was the golden moment, because they had felt that they had been ostracized or were in the exile from the Democratic Party during the Carter administration. I don't know if you remember that one neocon that I know named Peter Rosenblatt, Elliot Abrams had a famous line. Carter offered one job to a neocon, and it was to become ambassador to Micronesia. And Elliot Abrams famously said, not Macronesia, Micronesia.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, the 80s were a golden age. And I should mention that Ladin's sort of mentor or his great supporter was Al Haig, who was first Secretary of State under Reagan. And again, in the sort of Wall Street Journal reporting on the Italian connection, there's a lot of suggestion that Haig himself was also tied with Italian intelligence. And that certainly by this smear article against Jimmy Carter, Ladin had done a great service to the Reagan campaign. And so, you know, like in the sort of normal system of patronage, he was rewarded.
One interesting thing about Ladin that I remember from this era, just to give you a broader sense of his mindset, there was a long interview with him in the Washington Times. And there's a picture of him and with a big quote, and it said, power comes from the barrel of a gun. So, you know, he essentially was a kind of a Maoist in this administration. I mean, these guys, again, you see these sort of precursor elements of Trumpism. I'm not trying to read back too much into history or be too teleological. But I do believe that with Ladin, with this skepticism about mass democracy and the embrace of military power, the affinity for authoritarian movements abroad, maybe he was kind of a trailblazer among the neocons.
Well, I think maybe one way to think about it is, you know, like I think there's always a contradiction within in neoconservatism between the sort of pro-democracy ideas and the sort of, you know, use of militarism. And I think that, you know, one could say some of the people, you know, I'd mentioned he came out of the same generation as Arch Puddington and others. And I think those people did have, you know, like there's many policy disputes I would have with them. You know, I might question whether, you know, funding the Contras actually supported democracy, whatever. But they, I think their commitment to, they did have some genuine commitment to democracy, balancing off the militarism. Whereas I think Ledeen, you know, is definitely on the more militaristic end of things. And he is someone who, like, you know, admires the sort of man of action, whether it's Gabriel D'Annunzio or I think he's also a fan of James Jesus Angleton, the CIA head of counterintelligence, who is, you know, did many nefarious deeds, and admirer, frankly, of Machiavelli. And so I think that Machiavellian side of things was the, you know, one could fairly say was the more dominant personality of his brand of neoconservatism, even though he also used all the rhetoric of democracy promotion. Do you think that's fair?
Yes, absolutely. I actually think that Ledeen probably became radicalized as he went along, too. Mm-hmm. And not to push the story too far ahead, but, you know, mm-hmm. we can talk later about Barbara Ledeen and the formation of the Independent Women's Forum and the and their attacks on Sidney Blumenthal. I mean, I think Ledeen is different from someone like Muravchik, who never really became a Republican and would sort of mm-hmm. hold his nose about the GOP or mm-hmm. Arch Puddington. These guys at their core still had, I think, you know, they had been shaped by their formative years, whereas Ledeen was far more, I think the word for Ledeen he's much more ruthless, frankly.
Yeah. No. I think we'll return to that when we get to the Iraq War and his sort of, you know, ideological rationale. But I did want to talk a little bit about Iran-Contra. So, like, you know, just to spell out his kind of role with that, right? Like, he was, helped introduce members of the Reagan administration to this Iranian arms dealer who claimed, you know, he had connections within Tehran, and he wasn't like more operationally involved. He got the ball rolling, but he did not. Was never criminally charged, unlike many other people in Iran-Contra, which I think is, again, it sort of follows a pattern. Like he's always someone who's like, you know, stays on the right side of the law, but even as he's connected with these nefarious actors.
Yeah, it's important to know. I mean, I met Ledeen once and on an occasion in which he upbraided me. But, you know, he's a sophisticated guy. Mm-hmm. And I think some of the others got, you know, Elliot Abrams was much younger then. Mm-hmm. And Oliver North was mm-hmm. a fanatic, frankly. Yeah. And those guys, you know, well, they... North obviously turned it to his advantage, but it was an interesting episode in the conservative attack on government from within.
Yeah.
Ledeen got the ball rolling, but these guys were willing to essentially start a secret government within the bowels of the White House. The Iran-Contra almost brought down Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's important to emphasize this was a constitutional crisis. I mean, Congress had decreed that there were to be no funding to the Contras. And this is like under the Constitution, that is the power of Congress. They're the only ones that can raise money and decide how it's spent. To have a government raise money through like this other means of selling weapons, like fundamentally undermines checks and balances. Like I know there's a long revisionist tendency to like downplay Iran-Contra, but like, you know, on a fundamental level, this is a real attack on democracy. And the idea of a government within a government, I mean, again, you know, like the SISMI stuff, I think is kind of pertinent because I mean, one of the scandals of SISMI was basically that they were a government within the government of Italy, that they were like, you know, doing all sorts of illegal things outside of parliamentary control. So, you know, there are definitely these tendencies. But again, he sort of kept his hands clean and was more the kind of like theorist or initiator. But as you said, like, you know, there's a kind of radicalization. I think this is true of someone like Elliot Abrams as well, that they felt that the scandal and the fact that Abrams and others were charged, they saw that that was a dirty trick on the part of the Democrats, and I think that this actually hardened their politics of that cohort of neoconservatives and made them much more a partisan and militant and maybe a little much more skeptical of sort of constitutional democracy.
Among some, I mean, we.
Yeah, yeah. I'm talking about specifically that circle that was like, you know, really involved with Iran-Contra. Whereas I think, as you're right, that we it's important to have a sense of a spectrum of among the neoconservatives. And there were others who weren't that way and who actually, you know, were happy to vote for Bill Clinton when he came around, right? But I think that the partisan element of Iran-Contra hardened that that identity that you identified, that sort of hard Republican, certainly among Elliot Abrams, and I think among Ladin.
I think it's important because it gets at this distinction between what's happened today and what our friend David Kleon is writing about his history of neocons, which is that there what we really have today is a bifurcation, right? Mm-hmm. You have Bill Kristol and others who have refused to go along with Trump. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And are actually sincere defenders of the Constitution. And then you have this other camp in the Claremont Institute mm-hmm. and elsewhere that is full on for Trump and has abandoned any pretense of trying to protect American democracy.
Yeah, no. I think that's exactly right. And there are probably like many different causes for this. I think part of it depends on the sort of priority one gives to social issues or how afraid one is of liberalism and the left. But I certainly think like Iran-Contra was a kind of turning point for some of these figures in terms of making them partisan. And, you know, you mentioned Sidney Blumenthal. I think the fact that, you know, who was a reporter at the time for The Washington Post and wrote some very critical things about Ladin. So I think that some of the figures like Ladin came to see the media and liberal culture as, a far more hostile force. This perhaps explains why they ended up on the sort of hardline camp that ended up as Trumpist, as against other neoconservatives who basically returned to the Democratic Party fold, right? So I think that sort of makes sense with the proviso that I think with Ladin, you know, like a lot of these anti-democratic tendencies, you know, were basically there in his writing in the 70s. And we're certainly there, as we've seen, with his ties with Italian intelligence.
Something can be embryonic and then come to full bloom.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And so I think that maybe the next major turning point was this sort of 9/11 and then the sort of global war on terror, where I think this is the sort of second blossoming of neoconservatives. This is the point where the Republican administration once again finds the neoconservatives very useful for promoting a foreign policy agenda. And I think that the sort of divide that you mentioned about sort of both, wanting to promote democracy and then, you know, having these militaristic programs that are anti-democratic are very evident in Ladin. Like he's basically, you know, one of the people saying, you know, we need a global democratic revolution and America's the great revolutionary power. But he also said other things, one of which is a comment he reportedly made at the American Enterprise Institute, reported by Jonah Goldberg, which he said was after 9/11, every 10 years or so, the United States needs to pick up some small, crappy little country and throw it against the wall just to show the world we mean business. And so I think that that language, I mean, that's not democracy promotion, right? That is like straight on realpolitik of the crassest sort, you know, sort of crackpot realism.
Now, that is, it's so interesting you say that, Jeet, because it reminds me, I was at a Library of Congress session that was in honor of Henry Kissinger. And all the big guys, the big shots were there, Sam Huntington and Donald Kagan and so forth. Kissinger gets up at this session and says, I supported the Iraq War, the second Iraq War, not because it was necessary, but because it was unnecessary.
Yeah, well, there you go. There you go. So this is the it shows the sort of like wider resonance of this sort of thinking. But I want to emphasize this is this basically on the one hand gives lie to the idea of democracy promotion and also suggests something a little bit more sinister in the sort of politics and something very sinister that has domestic implications as well. Another comment he made around this time in March of 2003, when people were worried that the American public would lose heart if there was too many casualties, he said, "All the great scholars who have studied American character have come to the conclusion that we are a warlike people and that we love war." And he meant this in a positive way, what is one to say about this vision that, America is a country that loves war and that's a great thing?
It's nonsensical, I think. But we should point out that Ledeen, during this time, his home base was the American Enterprise Institute, where a number of refugees from the Reagan administration went, including Gene Kirkpatrick was at that time the head of AEI's foreign policy division. But Ledeen was just scavenging through American history to back his own revolutionary program. But there's no American history, testifies more to isolationism than to desire to get entangled in foreign wars. So I don't know what Ledeen was basing this comment on.
Yeah, I don't know. It's absolutely the case that all wars in American history, including ones that are we see as popular, like the Second World War, had huge popular opposition as well. The war has never been a unifying force in American history, and certainly with the Iraq War, that was as the casualties, as the body bags came coming home, the public soured on the war.
I just want to interject too. Richard Hofstadter, the famous historian from Columbia University, also towards the end of his life published a great essay in the New York Times Magazine called "Uncle Sam Has Cried Uncle Before," and yes. his essay was addressed to the Vietnam War, and he was saying, the idea that America always wins its wars is patriotic bilge. In fact, we've lost or had many inconclusive wars, and there's nothing, shameful about recognizing that maybe we should be more careful.
No, absolutely. At this stage, Ledeen the scholar has been, left far behind, and he's a sort of propagandist. And I want to, return to the Italian connection, because I think that this is very key. So we had mentioned it was through Italian intelligence that he was trying to smear Jimmy Carter. And actually, at that same time, Ledeen was a big proponent of the idea that there was a so-called Bulgarian connection to the assassination of the Pope, the attempted assassination, which, the information for all that came from a sort of Italian, from SISMI, Italian intelligence. And then the third time, this recurs is in with the Iraq War, but you want to say something?
I do. It's important on this Bulgarian connection. This was aired by a woman named Claire Sterling. I don't know if you remember her.
I remember.
And the New Republic. Network. She was a friend of Marty Peretz's, actually. Yeah. And I believe the New Republic ran with this too. Now this was this fantasy on the right, on the American right, that the assassination of the Pope could be traced back to the Kremlin. Mm-hmm. That, the wish was the father of the thought here.
Yes, absolutely. And one should actually mention, I'm glad you mentioned the New Republic, because they were also the ones that published the sort of smearing of Jimmy Carter stories that Ledeen wrote, and he wrote for them in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And the New Republic was a kind of, center liberal magazine, but still at that point had a real liberal reputation based on history. And I think that, Ledeen, because of his scholarly background, because he sometimes used the rhetoric of democratization, was able to make inroads among sort of centrist liberal thought. And I think there was actually a famous controversy where a Partisan Review had wanted to publish an essay by him. Partisan Review, the great magazine of the New York intellectuals, not so great in the 1980s, but still it had this reputation. And that article, the acceptance of that article came at the same time as Iran-Contra. And then a lot of people on the editorial board of Partisan Review basically threatened to resign if they published that article. So there was a way in which Ladin was, banking on his reputation on the left or his history on the left to try to make inroads among sort of liberal thought. And there were places like, Marty Prince's New Republic that were more than happy to cooperate with that.
Now, it's interesting because Leon Wieseltier, who became the literary editor of the New Republic, I recall him telling me that Ladin had wildly exaggerated his affiliation with the magazine, which is certainly possible.
Yeah.
But
Ladin did publish there. I mean, like, there's
no, yeah, no, yeah, I
he
know.
Did publish in the book review section. And I'm sure, and the New Republic at that point famously had a lot of contending forces within it. But I absolutely, there's no denying the fact that Ladin's articles were being published in the New Republic at that point.
Right. I think he claimed that he was its Rome correspondent. I don't know if that was true or not. I think that's what the issue of contention was.
I would Rome correspondent for the New Republic.
Yeah.
That's a great idea. But the third fabrication coming out of Italian intelligence was in the time of the Iraq War. And this was the famous yellow cake. That was the smoking gun of weapons of mass destruction, which, like the Billy Carter scandal and like the Bulgarian connection for the papal assassination, was a fraud, right? So what are we to kind of like make of that? Like was it part of his job to sort of launder these Italian fabrications? Was there some this is all speculative, but I maybe you can speculate a little bit about what he was doing.
Well, I think he was a master self-promoter, to be honest.
Yeah.
And his fingerprints are always appearing on these, but he had the ties to Italy. I just don't know, curveball was also an important part of this in duping the administration about, the Iraqi, supposed Iraqi defector in Germany. Dick Cheney, Vice President Dick Cheney, who pushed this uranium yellow cake theory, was being told what he wanted to hear. I don't think anyone was actually fooled by any of this. I think they saw what they wanted to see. And Ladin was obviously played a role in helping to promote that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think that's I think that's fair. I would say it ties in maybe with the larger international networks of the right as well, that oftentimes information that you can't get accepted through legitimate sources in the United States, not even Marty Prince's New Republic, but you can maybe get printed up in a British tabloid and then it starts to circulate and then can be echoed in talk radio. And I think Italian intelligence had maybe that same sort of function that, there's stuff that you can't necessarily get into the New York Times, but if you, have someone saying, these sources from Italy that are saying this, it's a way of getting ideas out there and of laundering ideas that you want to promote. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah. Someone just recently described Ladin to me as a, quote, incorrigible practitioner of dirty tricks, unquote.
Yeah.
Referring to actually both to him and his wife, Barbara Ladin. Mm-hmm. Because you remember there was a smear attempt against Sidney Blumenthal, too, when he was working in the Clinton White House, that he was supposedly abusing his wife and then Matt Drudge ran with this, and both Ledeens got tangled up in this lawsuit that Blumenthal lodged against Drudge.
Yeah. I had only vaguely remember that, but I mean, I'm glad you reminded that, because I mean, it does actually fit into this sort of pattern of dirty tricks. And you know, as you mentioned, this is Ledeen's second wife, Barbara. He's been married to since the early 70s, and she's a very prominent sort of Republican operative as well. And also more recently involved with, I believe, under the first Trump administration, she was sort of pushing for the sort of prosecution of Hillary Clinton, and was, you know, like involved with other sorts of activities. So again, this all kind of suggests it's something that you had mentioned, which is a sort of hyper-partisan Republican identity.
Exactly. And that is what is proven so corrosive and what many Democrats have yet to realize, which is that the Republican Party and its spear carriers are trying to extirpate the Democratic Party at this point. I mean, that to me is what Trumpism is about. It's not about combating Democrats. It's about eliminating them.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair analysis. And I mean, again, it takes us back to this sort of like, you know, sort of fascism question, right? You know, like, because I think that there is a, you know, kind of ordinary partisan politics and ordinary sort of, you know, Republican and Democratic politics, you know, which uses dirty tricks, which is like, you know, which is paints its enemy in a very negative light, but is still roughly within the boundaries of, you know, like democratic contest where you have a loyal opposition and where you have the switching of parties. Whereas with Ledeen, like, it seems like, you know, we're in a different kind of territory.
You know what I think we're in? I think we're in the territory of McCarthyism. You know, in his new book on William F. Buckley, Sam Tannenhaus's biography, he points to that famous quote in the book by Buckley and Brent Bozell, McCarthy and His Enemies, which is a defense of McCarthyism. And there's that famous line towards the end where they say, "For now, we will focus on fleshing out the communists, but the liberals' turn will come soon."
Yeah.
That is a direct threat. Mm-hmm. And to me, to me, Ledeen and now Trump embody that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's I think that's exactly right. That is the kind of lineage. And it's worth emphasizing that, like, among the neoconservatives, this is actually this sort of McCarthy question has always been a kind of divide as well, which, you know, as a historian of neoconservatism, you will kind of know very well. Like, I think, you know, going back to the early 50s, the real divide among Cold War liberals came from those who started to embrace McCarthy, like as James Burnham and Wilmore Kendall did, and those who said, well, this is like a bridge too far. And someone like Irving Kristol at that point tried to straddle the difference and say, you know, this famous kind of, he wasn't pro-McCarthy, but he was, I would say, anti-McCarthy, saying that, you know, like, the American people know one thing about Joe McCarthy, that, you know, he's against communism, and they can't say the same for liberals. And so I think in that sort of McCarthyist moment, you see this kind of fissure point among Cold War liberals. And I think it's being replicated now in the sort of neoconservative struggle where, you know, some people, you know, basically say, you know, Trump and his threat to democracy is a bridge too far. And there's other group that are trying to straddle the difference as Irving Kristol did and are anti-Trumpist. They won't positively defend Trump, but they will say, like, you know, well, the liberals are kind of worse. And then there's others who are like wholeheartedly embrace Trump because they hate the left so much and do agree that it needs to be destroyed. And Ledeen is definitely of the third camp.
Now, one thing we'll be wholly remiss if we don't discuss really is Iran, which has become the live wire issue in the Trump administration right now. Michael Ledeen made it his life's mission to push for a military assault on the regime. He wanted regime change in Iran. He didn't just want to wipe out the nuclear facilities. And right now you have Bibi Netanyahu apparently chomping at the bit to initiate a strike on Iranian nuclear facilities, which I'm convinced would lead to an utter disaster in the Middle East. I mean, you're talking about the Iranians shutting down the Iranian Gulf, at the Persian Gulf. It's not yet called the Gulf of America there, I guess, by Trump. And at the same time, you have the Trump administration apparently at war with itself over Iran, too. You've got the hawks in the administration, and then you've got Trump himself, who has always seemed wary of a war. But it'll be interesting. You know, Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, actually gave a eulogy for Ladin. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah. No. And specifically singling out, his work in trying to pushing for regime change in Iran. No, that's absolutely right. And I always remember this moment because I'd written about it in 2006, where he was addressing a group of Iranians in America, and he said, you know, like for $20 million, we could overthrow the regime in Iran, which I think gets to the sort of huckster opportunistic side of him, because I gotta tell you, it's gonna take more than $20 million to do that. But certainly that was like his major cause over the last 2 decades or more, and he had actually promoted the idea that, you know, Iran is basically the root of all evil in the Middle East.
After 9/11, actually, he was disappointed that Bush didn't go for Iran rather than Iraq. Yeah. But, you know, Bush wasn't that crazy.
That's a slogan. Real men go to Iran. basically out of time now. But this is very large legacy. And I think, we can kind of maybe agree that he's part of this larger movement. And there are many other people. And he was in the cases with the weapons of mass destruction, perhaps in the service of someone like Cheney. But I also think a very important figure in his own right. Like, I think Ladin, even though he's often in the background, you know, like you can kind of see him at all these important junctures of history. And he was a Forrest Gump.
It's amazing. It shows you how, you know, someone who basically was an obscure academic can come to Washington and through sheer ideological fervor gain a foothold and some measure of influence.
It is a truly remarkable story. And perhaps, one could wish one could go back in history and the university in St. Louis could have given him his tenure. Things could have turned out very differently. I want to thank Jacob for being on the podcast.
Thank you, Jeet.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your 2 free gifts with purchase. WATER to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethost.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.